evacuation places. On the invitation of Rhineland Palatinate Minister of Justice Herbert Merton, Klopp had taken the squad for a visit to the Rohrbach Federal Prison. One inmate told the coach that he had once sat next to him on a fan bus journey to a Mainz second division game when Klopp had been suspended and travelled with the supporters. The Mainz manager listened attentively to the inmate's life story. "Man, you have to get your life in order when you get out," he advised him. Frankfurter Rundschau reported. Klopp told the paper it was important for his players to experience a completely different world that's anything but fun and luxury. That kind of thing helps you grow as a human being and as a player, even if it doesn't quite help you win against Bayern. The best part of the unusual trip, however, was the chance to get the boys in here a few extra hours outside their cells, he added. Having been told that there was no live football on television inside the jail, Klopp asked Merton to install a pay TV decoder to enable the inmates to watch Mainz's match versus Bayern. The politician only smiled at the brazen suggestion, but felt that the team visit might have served as a kickstart for the rehabilitation of some of the convicts. Back on the pitch, Mainz drew 2-2 with Bayern. It would be a disaster if Mainz were to go down, Bayern general manager Uli Hoeneß said after the evenly contested 90 minutes. A nervy 3-0 win away to VfL Wolfsburg put the club in a very promising position. And on the penultimate match day, it was carnival time at the Bruchweg once more. Mainz beat Schalke 1-0. They were safe. A tearful, beer-drained Klopp mounted the stadium fence to sing punch-drunk songs with the fans. "He's the ultra among the Bundesliga coaches," Süddeutsche Zeitung wrote, "and Mainz 05 has become the expression of his personality. A club where both players and the crowd were whipped into a frenzy by the man on the sideline, and tens of thousands were living in step with the emotions prescribed by their coach." After a nil-all draw at Duisburg on the final day of the season, the poorest side in the league, their wage bill of €13 million, was less than half of the average for the other 17 sides, €28 million, were once again ranked the 11th best team in the country. Some players wondered whether they had actually underachieved in view of their playing capabilities, but Friedrich maintained that the club knew exactly what they had done. "Being able to play in the Bundesliga again next year is the greatest thing for us," he said. "We still experience each game as a present, like a kid with wide eyes." Like a discreetly out-of-tune violin among a philharmonic orchestra, however, two small, annoying quibbles jarred with the celebrations ever so slightly. Mainz fans had angrily jeered former FSV midfielder Mimoun Azao during the Schalke match, a sign, perhaps, that the self-styled party club was becoming a bit less special, more like a normal one. "That's not who we are," Klopp castigated the supporters. Secondly, regular observers noted that Heidel protested a little too vigorously when someone put it to him that the losses of playmaker De Silva to Stuttgart and key striker Mohamed Zidane back to Werder would be tough to compensate. "We've been hearing that for 15 years now," he said dismissively. But that summer, the floodgates opened. In addition to De Silva and Zidane, striker Benny Auer and defender Matthias Abel also left. Most damaging in more ways than one was the departure of a fifth regular, Michael Tuch. The forward's 12 goals in 2005-06 had gone a long way to keeping Mainz safe, as had his 6 goals in the second half of the previous season. Tuch was the type of striker Germans called a Schlitzohr, literally a cut-up ear. The expression goes back a few hundred years to when apprentice craftsmen wore golden earrings and had them ripped out as a punishment for misdemeanours. Tuch was a street hustler on the pitch, a lovable hoodlum, a serial irritant for defenders. He'd grown up in the Gallus Quarter of Frankfurt, an industrial working-class district, wedged in by two major railway lines. Locals refer to the area as Kamerun, due to its high level of immigrants. Tuch's brace on the final day of the 2003-04 season against Eintracht Trier had lifted Mainz to the Bundesliga. But he had cast a solitary, distraught figure amidst the ecstatic festivities. Tuch had agreed to move to Energie Cottbus for the coming season, in anticipation of the East German club's promotion to the top division. But in Energie's place, Mainz had gone up. "I feel like shit. Do I really have to go there?" Tuch muttered throughout the party in the city centre, crying inconsolably. Heidel had promised the forward that he'd be welcome to return if his transfer to Cottbus didn't work out. When it didn't, Turk paid part of his transfer fee to facilitate his return in January 2005. In Mainz's history, we have made two incredibly good personal decisions, Strutt said later. One is Klopp, the other one was to take back Turk from Cottbus. What this guy is on the pitch is incredible. In July 2006, Turk learned of interest from Eintracht Frankfurt. The move to his hometown was hugely attractive to him, emotionally and financially. Mainz wanted him to stay. Turk provoked a falling out with Heidel and Klopp to force through his sale. He professed himself disappointed that the Mainz general manager had not informed him of Eintracht's inquiries, then attacked Klopp for not backing him enough in relation to a possible call-up by the national team. I have to think about that, the Mainz coach had, truthfully, answered when someone had asked him about Turk's prospect with Klinsmann. That's not simply a negative statement about a player, Turk complained. I felt as if he was making fun of me. But the 30-year-old went further, much further. Klopp, Turk said, was some kind of super guru, whose man-management prowess was vastly overrated. This constant cheerfulness, always a funny quip, the stuff he says in the team meetings, his way of motivating, I switch off, because I've heard it 1,000 times before. It's worn thin. Many of the things he says, I can't hear anymore. There was no going back after that. Mainz sold him to their local rivals. The switch didn't work out for Turk, however. He only scored 4 goals in 36 games before moving on to FC Augsburg. The stuff Turk said was unforgivable. It was scorched earth stuff, says Kvast. Kloppo was God in Mainz. You can't do that. It got very personal. After their many car journeys together to and from Frankfurt, they'd become very close, like Topf und Arsch, pot and bum. It was calculated by Misha. He knew the club had to sell him. But how do you deal with a guy like that? For a while, their relationship was very tense. I was sure Kloppo would break off all contact. But then, 2015-16, Augsburg are playing at Liverpool. And who's there, sitting in the VIP box next to Ulla, Klopp's wife, Michael Turk? Kloppo had invited him as a guest of honour. Turk had played for Augsburg, so it was his game too, in a way. There was no grudge, no ill feeling at all. That's cool. I respect people who can let bygones be bygones like that. The start to the 2006-2007 season was spectacular. Rafael Benitez's Liverpool were demolished 5-0 in a friendly at the Brückweg. Mainz beat VfL Bochum 2-1 in the first Bundesliga game of the season. But that was it as far as wins were concerned. The newly built team couldn't make the demanding system work. 8 draws and 8 defeats left them propping up the table at the halfway mark. Turk's attack supplied an easy explanation for Mainz's terrible results. Klopp could no longer inspire the dressing room. Maybe he was too busy analysing the national team's games for ZDF to pay attention to mundane Bundesliga matters, the tabloids wondered. Strutt says that wasn't the problem. Before one game against Schalke 04, Klopp made an unbelievable speech in the press conference. He just talked and talked, and at the end I was sure we would go and win. I asked one of the cameramen to give me the tape. We will keep our naive belief, Klopp had said. We won't go to Schalke feeling small with our backs bowed or broken. Whoever stays the course, never gives up, never stops working, will be rewarded at the end. That's my fundamental belief. We will keep on fighting until someone tells us. You can stop now, the season's over. Mainz lost the game 4-0. The match before the winter break, at home to FC Bayern, brought the same scoreline. A Mexican wave swept through the sold-out Brückweg, one part defiance, two part gallows humour. Strutz didn't like it. I would have preferred it if the crowd had really jeered the players instead. The club bosses agreed that the team, especially some of the new recruits, lacked ability and application. There would be some changes during the holidays, but not on the bench. Heidel declared Klopp unsackable. We would jump for joy if he extended his contract beyond 2008 with us, he told the press. Klopp denied that his team had been afraid of the Bavarians' visit. We didn't shit ourselves, I had a look before, and stayed stoically upbeat. The break would offer a chance to make the requisite changes. In any case, he told reporters, finishing the year off bottom of the Bundesliga wasn't his worst ever Christmas. When I was 5 years old, I wanted a Bonanza bike. I got one, but our neighbour Franz, who played Santa Claus, sat down on it as a joke. The wheel rim was bent like an 8. I couldn't ride it, and I was very upset. It didn't feel as if the house was on fire, says Nevin Subotic, sitting in the quaint Tasty Pasty Company, an exposed brick cafe run by a very chatty British expat in Cologne. That season, it wasn't pure chaos or anarchy, it was business as usual. We trained hard and played with a clear plan at the weekend, knowing that winning a point would be great. That was our focus. There was no sense of grave frustration. It didn't feel as if nothing was working for us. I think everybody knew that we didn't have the quality of the bigger sides, that we basically belonged down there. As a young player, I was very preoccupied with myself anyway. Heidel spent money to stem the tide. Mohamed Little Pharaoh Zidane, a happy-go-lucky striker who, like Turk, only ever fulfilled his potential under Klopp, was bought back from Werder Bremen for €2.8 million in January, a record signing for Mainz. Danish midfielder Leon Andreasen, also from Werder, came in on a six-month loan to shore up the centre. Colombian winger Elkin Soto was plucked from utter obscurity. He was out of contract after a spell at CD Once Caldas. The supporters, too, got a move on. They started a campaign called Mission Possible 15 to save Mainz 05 from relegation. 15th place was enough for survival. The Mainz Ultras promised themselves to make the Bruchbach Stadion, where FSV had become a bit of a pushover, a noisy cauldron once more. Klopp, described as a young, unshaven man forever jumping up and down on an imaginary bouncy castle in The Guardian, made the most of the restart. Zidane, Andreasen, and to a lesser extent the soon-to-be-injured Soto, were key factors in winning five of the first six games in the Rückrunde. Mainz were 10th. There was talk about reaching the UEFA Cup for a second time. "My teammates fight as if the opponents are threatening to take away their children," Andreasen said admiringly. Strutz hailed the team the Bravehearts of the Bundesliga. Any similarities with Scottish insurgents proved superficial, however. Underneath Mainz's kilts, there wasn't that much going on. Refereeing mistakes, injuries, goal-scoring opportunities wasted, silly goals conceded. The familiar litany of relegated sides since time eternal. All of it true, all of it was to blame, to an extent, for Mainz losing seven of the following nine games. More importantly, the disastrous first half of the season had made the margin for error too small for a side of 05's limited capabilities. A home win on the penultimate day of the season, 3-0 to Gladbach, came too late. Mainz would have had to beat FC Bayern 7-0 away to have had a shot at staying up. There was no realistic prospect of achieving such a result on a PlayStation, let alone at the Allianz Arena. The Bundesliga adventure was over. FSV were going down after 102 games at the top. For Subotic, it was relegation in his first season as a professional football player, but, surprisingly, not that painful. "The mood in the dressing room was good until the very end," he says. "We stayed a team, we stayed together. That was a very important experience for me. It helped me to grow as a player. It didn't get significantly worse or louder towards the end. Maybe a little, but not by much." The Braunschweig certainly didn't lose its voice. Standing ovations accompanied a lap of honour after the final whistle in the Gladbach game. "We want to see the team. Chance forced the squad to come out of the dressing room for a second round. They sang, 'You'll never walk alone again.' My handkerchiefs are wet," German FA president Dr. Theo Schweinsteiger admitted. "Football can't achieve more than it has here with us," Strutz said about the emotional farewell. Klopp took the microphone. Once again, a cartoon figure provided the impulse for his speech. Paraphrasing the end credits of the German version of the animated Pink Panther show, he promised that, "This is not the end of all days. We'll be back without doubt," like the Pink Philosopher said. Klopp almost sounded happy about the relegation for bringing out the true football soul of Mainz, Frankfurter Allgemeine felt. The drop-down wasn't treated as a catastrophe, but accepted as a rather inevitable setback. "All that has happened is what everybody has always expected," the broadsheet wrote. Klopp: "It's amazing to see how people deal with relegation. That's what life is about. If you've given it your all and have failed, you can deal with the situation. People and the club have reacted in a classy manner. Here, players will never be idiots for losing a game." In Munich, FSV players and officials wore red top hats before kick-off and held up a banner in front of their travelling supporters. "We take our hats off to you," it read. Klopp confessed to a spell of introspection. "I questioned myself. If I'd found I was 90% responsible for relegation, I would have to draw the necessary conclusions. That's not the case. But pledged his allegiance. I don't have the right to stop now. I want to make sure I can live in Mainz after I retire or get fired somewhere, without there being any open questions. He accepted that some players wanted to leave for other Bundesliga clubs, he added. But the situation was different for him. I'm nearly 40. I can do my job for a few more years. I'm not running out of time. Players have less time. They have to do these things. For me, it's about living up to my responsibility. I'm happy to do that. Chapter 11. 1, 2 and Almost 3. Dortmund 2010 to 2013. Nuri Sahin, Mats Hummels, Marcel Schmelzer, Nevin Subotic and Sven Bender looked at each other and started giggling in disbelief, like schoolboys who had just pulled off the most elaborate prank on their teacher. The moment lasted only 2 seconds, says Hummels, but it felt like 2 hours. The 80,000 punch-drunk screaming supporters on the terraces were shaking the signal in Duna Park so hard that time itself became unstuck. Stadium announcer Norbert Dickel had set off the earthquake, crying out that Köln were 2-0 up at Leverkusen, Dortmund's last remaining rival for the top spot. BVB were leading 2-0 against 1 FC Nürnberg, only 20 minutes away from winning the Bundesliga title, with 2 games to spare. We knew then that he had done it. We couldn't quite comprehend it, says Hummels of that unforgettable day in April 2011. Subotic, we were babies. Most of us, we weren't even 23 yet. We had no idea what was happening to us. We knew we were there, but we didn't quite know how we got there and what being there actually meant. Bender, I had goosebumps like never before in my life. It was a brutally emotional moment, a realization. We, a bunch of kids, had done it. Looking back, I'm almost sad I couldn't enjoy it more. But it was just too unreal and over too quickly to take in its entirety. Klopp was equally unable to fully appreciate the occasion. I thought it would feel better, more euphoric, he said, almost apologetically. Perhaps the pressure on us was a little stronger than we were prepared to admit. For everyone else, the minutes, hours and days afterwards were a blur. Kevin Grosskreutz, running around with a partially shaved head like a madman, the batteries of the electric razor had run out. Keeper Roman Weidenfeller, telling an Al Jazeera reporter in a hilarious mix of German and English, "We have a grandiose Saison gespielt." Fans hugging, crying. 500,000 people in the streets of Dortmund. Beer, champagne, Subotic. 2 weeks of emergency rule. BVB President Reinhold Rabul. It was total ecstasy, impossible to put into words, Hummel says. You had a town mad about football, a club mad about football, and a coach in Klopper who always put the supporters at the heart of things in a very extreme manner. The combination of all of that created an energy that people still talk about today and will never stop talking about. Sebastian Kiel, one of a handful of players over 30, had experienced winning the title with Dortmund before in 2002, as had Weidenfeller. Borussia's financial near-death experience in the intervening years made the 2010-2011 league win more special still, he explains. To see the joy in people's eyes after they'd been worried for so long about the future of their club and had wished for the glory days to return, we felt so incredibly happy for them. We were able to give something in return to them after all those difficult years. I think people there have never forgotten and will never forget it either. Nothing had prepared anyone of a black and yellow disposition for this triumph. No disrespect to the guys from the 1950s, but in my view, this is the biggest success in the history of the club, said Michael Zorc. The sporting director had won the Champions League with Borussia as a player in 1997, but felt that this side, the youngest ever Bundesliga champions, had achieved more. No one expected us to have a chance, let alone dominate the league to such an extent, he said. When we won previous titles, we were at least among the favourites. Another Europa League spot had been seen as a realistic target for a team without expensive stars. Striker Robert Lewandowski commanding the only significant outlay, and a coach who had never come near a trophy as a player or manager before. Klopp's guidance was the essential factor in making Borussia great again, Hans-Joachim Watzke says. But the club also benefited from Zorc firing magic bullets in the transfer market ahead of the campaign. We got very lucky with quite a few of the signings Zorc made, in close cooperation with Jürgen and me, Dortmund's CEO admits. In that respect, the summer of 2010 was probably the luckiest of all. The arrival of Lewandowski, a muscular but very mobile centre-forward, reduced Klopp's reliance on the less technically gifted Lucas Barrios and increased his tactical options. The unknown Pole, a future world-class number 9, was often deployed as a second striker or number 10 behind his Argentinian teammate in his debut Bundesliga season. In attacking midfield, Shinji Kagawa, 21, bought from Japanese second division side Sassuolo Osaka for the bargain basement sum of €350,000, added agility and guile next to another de facto new addition, 18-year-old Mario Götze. The son of an IT professor and product of Borussia's youth system, effortlessly fizzed past opponents to inject even more speed into Borussia's offensive game. Matthias Sammer, the German FA sporting director, hailed Super Mario, Bild, as one of the greatest talents we ever had. The trio's interlocking moves gave Dortmund another dimension in the final third. They opened up our game, says Subotic. The biggest improvement stemmed from the squad's tactical progress, however. After two full seasons, Klopp's Jagd Fußball, hunting football, was becoming second nature, a collective ritual, accepted and practiced without hesitation. We kept the core of the team, most of us, very young, says Subotic. We didn't get in players who were already at the height of their powers and perhaps on their way down again. Our guys hadn't fulfilled their potential yet. They wanted to do anything to get there. That was hugely important, as was the fact that we had people who had completely bought into the system. They believed in it. They lived it. They'd signed up to it, too. Ahead of the campaign, Klopp asked his players to put their name to a promise, containing 7 rules. BVB players agreed to unconditional dedication, passionate devotion, a determination to win, independent of the scoreline, a readiness to support everybody, a readiness to accept help, a readiness to put their quality wholly at the service of the team, a readiness to take on individual responsibility. It might sound stupid, but when things go like clockwork, you're happy to run, says Bender. You don't even feel it anymore. We were so united in our purpose, so clear, eager to help each other. We were blood brothers. We stopped asking questions, adds Hummels. We knew exactly what the coach wanted us to do, and it was actually fun to play that way, almost addictive. His classic phrase was, run like there is no tomorrow. Came easily to us. The team could see itself grow, says Subotic. Many were on the way up. That was fun. We had this confidence. We felt that we would play everybody off the park. When we didn't, we simply said, okay, lesson learned. We'll smash them next time. The first 2 years were like that, and in the third year, we did smash everybody. Any remnants of inhibition were discarded when Dortmund racked up 7 consecutive wins after a 2-0 opening day defeat at the Signal in Iduna Park to Bayer 04 Leverkusen. The irresistible run included a 3-1 win in the derby at Schalke, an edgy 2-0 home triumph over FC Bayern in October, Klopp's first league success against the Bavarians, and a fortuitous 2-1 over 1 FC Köln that showed that even the team's deficiencies could work in their favour. Klopp had worked in pre-season on toning down the wildness to make Dortmund's game a bit more rational, especially in possession. But full throttle was what they do best, Watzke remarked after the win against the Billy Goats. They're not good at winding down a game. Instead of settling for a respectable 1-1 draw at the Rhein Energy Stadion, Dortmund pushed forward with abandon in the final minutes, propelled by a will to win that was much greater than the fear of losing. None of us had won any significant titles. Of course we were hungry, Hummel said. Nuri Sahin popped up with a last-second strike that secured 3 points and top place in the table for the very first time under Klopp. Borussia hadn't occupied first place since winning the Meisterschaft in 2002. At Mainz and in the early months at Dortmund, Klopp's watchword had been geil. Both an adjective or an adverb, it carries a faint whiff of 1980s pop culture and literally translates as horny, but it can also refer to something very inspiring or impressive. Guile is the word that best describes my excitement, Klopp told Taz in 2004. The language I use is important. I need to get through to my players. But I don't use guile to come across as young or cool. I simply don't have a better word to describe something I happen to find exorbitantly beautiful. Guile was complemented by gear, greed in Klopp's phraseology in 2010-2011. The team needed to be greedy in chasing the ball, in covering the pitch, and in pursuit of results, he stipulated. Traditionally sinful traits, lust, gluttony, avarice, were thus recast as footballing virtues. There was to be no distinction between work and play, pain and pleasure. Self-sacrificial toiling could be a sensual, arousing experience. Klopp, feverishly saluting one tackles and clearances on the sidelines, was the physical manifestation of his teachings. He said things like, "I'm looking forward to this game with every fibre in my body." And it was so believable that 1 second later, you felt the same, Bender says. We learned to be completely in the moment, to think only from game to game. The idea that big targets had to be clearly articulated in order to be achieved was dismissed as counterproductive. Whoever says that has no idea, the coach explained. He set his men immediate, achievable targets. They had to win the next game. A slalom skier would never throw his hands up in the air in celebration after clearing the first gate, would he? He asked. Klopp set an example to the boys by behaving in accordance with his own convictions, says Fritz Lundschermann, the BVB team manager. His style, his mentality, he's quite a unit too. He's not a 1.75-metre man, he's 1.93 metres. A demolition bomb, pure dynamite. You only have to light the fuse, he used to say. Get on the wild ride. Most of the time, that's what happened. The other important advantage was the age of the team. It had become quite young quite quickly. Nevin, Mats, all these guys, they were all still kids and followed him like Jesus' disciples. They had a very strong bond. The extraordinary togetherness of the players wasn't limited to football matters. We used to get together, 10 of us, and play online for hours on end, says Subotic. We knew that wouldn't last forever. You get older, you have other interests. But at the time, it was a hugely important tool for us that brought us together. Looking back, Hummel says it was a unique situation. A highly talented group with world-class players, happy to hang out with each other like a gang. That special combination made everything possible. Dickel. There's an old saying in football. You have to be 11 friends. It's not totally wrong. If there are 8 friends in the team, that's already quite good. A united team created in Klopp's image, delivering a string of victories. There was no longer a need to deal with tactical dissidents because there weren't any. Even if somebody did harbour private doubts, the intensity in training had ramped up so much that natural selection precluded any deviation from the course. Only the fittest, most devoted followers could survive life in the fast lane. In the first year, it was rather normal football, with a pinch of Klopp's tactics, says Subotic. In the second year, it got spicier. In the third year, boom. We reached a whole new level, because all 25 players now truly got it. Training felt like war. The starting 11 playing versus subs. By the middle of the week, you sort of knew the lineups. You can't imagine how difficult these games were. You were used to having a bit of space and air to breathe, but that was all gone. Everyone attacked the ball. Everyone defended. Everyone pressed. These games were as hard as the real ones, perhaps even harder. The training week had a fixed pattern. Monday was a rest day. Tuesday, gym sessions, sprints, four-a-side games, tournament style. The winner stays. Subotic. Fun to start your week that way, but very demanding. You sprint all the time, challenge for the ball all the time. It's a workout, but you don't realise it. Wednesday, 11-a-side, 2 halves of 10 minutes, preceded by a warm-up with passing. Thursday, shooting on goal. For everybody, including defenders. After 2 extremely tough days, you needed to have a bit of fun. We sometimes adjusted the sessions to concentrate on a particular weakness of the opponent, to cross the ball in a certain way, for example. But you could shoot on goal unobstructed. I think every pub player would have said, "I'll be able to join in that session." Fridays were devoted to dead balls. Free kicks, but mostly corners. The same 2 teams were always up against each other, and the ball was live. There would be counter-attacks and counter-counter-attacks on a very small pitch, 30 metres long, with boards along the touchline to keep the ball in play. Subotic. Short and sweet, but tough as hell. 200 miles an hour for a few minutes. The score was kept throughout the season. The motivation was very high. Nobody wanted to lose. No prisoners. It was also your last chance to show the coach, "I'm here, I'm ready." A last, short, sharp jolt. Saturday was game time. Sundays were spent regenerating and doing warm downs. On top of these physical exertions, there were short and concise video analysis sessions. After a quick introduction by Klopp, Krawitz took over and showed the team clips of the next opponents, their dead ball pieces, their basic defence and attacking shapes, where they had problems or gaps. The whole routine was so brutal that there was no time to think at all, Subotic recalls. Which was just as well, because Klopp mandated that his men should live only for the moment and never contemplate matters beyond the next game. Meter by meter, tackle by tackle, and goal by goal, Dortmund were running away with the league, racking up win after win, while champions Bayern were ignominiously stuck in mid-table, slowly self-destructing under the high-handed leadership of Louis van Gaal. Bayer Leverkusen were doing much better, but they were Leverkusen, weren't they? A club with a well-deserved reputation for being bottlers. 3 months into the campaign, it dawned on Klopp and his men that they could go all the way. To keep the pressure off the team, any mention of winning the league was strictly banned, from the top down. "We're not talking about the Meisterschaft. I couldn't care less about the table," Klopp kept insisting. "I have 0.0% interest in the table. Anyone talking about winning the league now has no idea about football," said Zorc. Watzke too preached silence. "It's totally unrealistic to talk about the championship. We're not ready to burden our 7-8 players, who aren't even 23 years old yet, with that kind of baggage. Setbacks are guaranteed to happen." A few weeks later, Klopp found himself answering uncomfortable questions in a TV interview. "Why did the team play so poorly against Hanover?" WDR's Arne Ziegler inquired. "We have problems. So many problems," Klopp said, rubbing his eyes underneath his glasses. "The boys don't adhere to instructions. I can't get through to them. I'm not sure I'm the right coach anymore. We have to analyse the situation critically during the week. Maybe the players want to get rid of me. I'm a bit clueless at the moment, to be honest." The BVB coach also lamented that there were no alternatives to the 29-year-old Roman Weidenfeld in goal. "Today he was okay, but in the morning, after getting up, he looks horrible. We have no choice other than to drink enough until he looks better in our eyes." It was all a very good joke, of course, a feature for Ziegler's satirical football show. Dortmund had in fact won 4-0 at Hanover, and yet the skit served a serious purpose too, like many of Klopp's funny lines. His comedic qualities helped to release tension inside the dressing room, and also guaranteed that his players listened attentively. "His punchlines are perfect," says Watzke. "Jürgen is never monotonous or predictable. That keeps everybody's concentration." By January, BVB had opened up a 12-point gap. Mario Götze performed so well in the 3-1 win at Leverkusen that Klopp was forced to substitute him to save him from even more media hype and potential retribution from humiliated opponents. He'd played himself into a dreamlike state where every flick and turn was coming off. "Playing this well was so much fun, more than winning itself," Subotic smiles. "Our system gave us a huge advantage over everybody else. It was like fishing with the best bait in the world, or with a shotgun." True to Klopp's maxim of staying greedy, the team's physical output never dropped. They were to space what World Cup winner Takeda Kobayashi was to hot dogs. They ate it up until the opposition was blue in the face and going down with cramps. Subotic: "We ran our opponents into the ground, and they were totally shell-shocked. Their pressing game had by then become so refined that they were able to systematically direct the other team's attacking moves into the most congested areas or dead ends. When there's little pressure on the opposition defence and midfield, you can't stay too close to an attacker as a defender," Subotic explains. "They can simply play a long ball over the top and the attacker can run past me and it's a goal. But by pressuring their build-up play, you force them to play the ball early, under duress. Knowing that, I can anticipate where the ball is going to go, get really close to the attacker, and get ready to tackle before the pass has even been made. Gegenpressing is the world's best playmaker," Klopp later said, about his team's propensity to win the ball when opponents were in total disarray. "In areas on the pitch where only one or two clever moves were needed to get through on goal. In Sahin, they had the perfect man for those killer balls. Sometimes it felt as if he was 90% of the team," says Subotic. "It was like, get the ball to Nuri, he'll do something. If you saw him without a shirt, you thought, what, this tiny guy? But you couldn't get the ball off him. He was the brain and the leader." It was Sahin who effectively swung the game at Bayern on match day 24 with a wonderfully executed free kick, Dortmund second on the night. Borussia hadn't won in Bavaria's capital for 19 years. Most of my boys were still being breastfed then, Klopp joked. Before the game, general manager Uli Hoeneß had predicted a win with two goals or more, noting that, man for man, the champions had the better side. As far as the teams went, there was no comparison, however. Bayern were driftwood in a sea of yellow and black, wrote Süddeutsche Zeitung, in view of the host's helplessness against Dortmund's targeted aggression. Wherever star winger Arjen Robben went, two BVB players were already there, stepping on his toes. So emphatic, definitive, and hugely symbolic was the visitors' 3-1 triumph that Bayern officials were queuing up to congratulate them on winning the title. Klopp lost a pair of glasses and a few drops of blood, hugging his players a bit too forcefully after the final whistle. But that was a small price to pay for a result that knocked Bayern out of the title race and made the Meisterschaft Dortmund's to lose. They were 12 points clear with 10 games to go. We've now come to a point where we can say we can and want to be champions, Watzke declared. Irrespective of Klopp's protestations, I couldn't give a shit about the championship today. I'm too happy with the way we played, the coach insisted. Almost 7 years later, Watzke recalls sitting in the team bus outside the Allianz Arena after the game. I was sat next to Michael Zorc. I asked him, was that it? He said, not yet, but it's coming. I'll never forget that moment. We'd been dead as a dodo a few years before, and here we were, on the verge of a league title. It was unfathomable. Following a small wobble with a defeat in Hoffenheim and a draw against Mainz, Bayern employed mind games one more time. If I was wearing black and yellow pants, I wouldn't sleep soundly, Hoeneß said ahead of Dortmund's home game against Hanover. But Germany's most decorated club found that they weren't even best in class in talking a good game anymore. I wonder what Hoeneß's pants looked like before he went to bed, Klopp responded. Borussia won the game 4-1. 7 points ahead of Leverkusen, with 5 games to go. They were almost champions. Watzke was perhaps the last remaining pessimist. I'm a born sceptic. That made for a good partnership with Klopp, because scepticism is completely alien to him. He once said to me, I don't think about defeats. It's true. He's never spent a minute wondering what might happen if a game is lost. I'm the complete opposite. And I just could not believe that we could win the league with this team. 1 week before we won it, I doubted everything again. We had lost 1-0 at Gladbach, but Dortmund could not be denied. They were unstoppable. With every game, Klopp's team talks got clearer, louder and more precise, says Bender. He explained that we're in charge now. It was all down to us. We hardly needed any motivation, but his speeches were the icing on the cake. We went out and ran even more. The team was so infused with that need to exert maximum effort each time that they hated themselves for merely capitulating 2-0 at Werder Bremen a week after the title celebrations. Possibly still suffering from the aftereffects of the party, Dortmund were a shadow of themselves. We all sat in the bus in silence, ashamed, says Bender. But 30 minutes in, we looked at each other and thought, have we lost our minds? Are we totally insane? We were German champions. Who cares about losing that game? Let's sing! They sang all the way back to Dortmund. Bayern's unimaginative transfer dealings and discontinuity at a coaching level had let in outsiders before. VfB Stuttgart 2007 and VfL Wolfsburg 2009, seizing the crown, had come as shocks as well. This was different, however, much bigger. Borussia's Meisterschaft under Klopp opened up people's eyes to the potency of a collectivist approach. Ingenious tactics, faithfully implemented, could lift a team of youngsters, cheap left-field foreigners, and a handful of veterans to the point where they didn't just upset the odds, but set a new benchmark. The disruptive innovation underpinning their success was especially relevant to the Bundesliga, a league that had been steadily losing ground internationally due to financial restraints and a culture of passive coaching. Klopp's Dortmund showed a way to increase productivity with purely natural, renewable resources, a blue-collar work ethic, humility, cleverness. Outside Germany, experts took note too. 3 months before the title win, the technical staff of Italy's national team, coached by Cesare Prandelli, came to look at Borussia's training. The team's movement reminded them of Sacchi's Milan, they told a beaming Klopp afterwards. Watzke, The football we played was our unique selling point at the time. One shouldn't forget that Bayern weren't as good then. They didn't have today's quality and didn't spend that much money yet. It was a bit easier for us, but we were on this unbelievable run. You could feel that this team was only at the beginning of its development. Success brought its own trappings. Half the team received lucrative offers to switch clubs. But of the regulars, only Sahin moved on. Jose Mourinho's Real Madrid exercised a 12 million euro release clause to take the midfielder to the Bernabeu. Sahin's successor was 21-year-old Ilkay Gundogan from 1FC Nürnberg. Sitting in a Spanish restaurant in Manchester city centre 6 years later, the Gelsenkirchen-born son of Turkish immigrants remembers meeting Zorc and Klopp in a Dusseldorf airport hotel in spring 2011. I was playing for Nürnberg and the season was still going on. It was very hush-hush, he says. I have to say I was a little intimidated by him at first. He was so tall. We talked for half an hour by ourselves and it was obvious to me that I wanted to go to Dortmund afterwards. He's got this gift. He can totally captivate you, dazzle you, make you feel euphoric. I never met any other coach like him. He asked me, what would be your targets if you came to us? I said, to play as often and well as possible. You see, that's already the first mistake, he replied. It's not about playing often, but making the most of your time on the pitch. I can't promise that you'll play often, that's not possible. But I can promise that you will learn an incredible amount, and that we will be extremely successful if you all bring your potential to bear. I remember that clearly. That was the first time in football that somebody didn't promise me the stars, but was open and honest with me. I found that fascinating. Gundogan found the step up from Nürnberg very difficult, starting with the pre-season fitness regime. Players had to go on the notorious Chucky run set up by assistant coach Zeljko Buvac. 11 runs back and forth, with and without the ball, on a parkour that stretched the entire length of the pitch. After the 11th run, players had to hit the crossbar from the halfway line. Those who missed had to go on a 12th run. The hardest thing I've ever done. It was sick, Gundogan sighs, reliving the horror in his mind. But it was important. Surviving that session gave us plenty to talk about. It brought the team closer. You felt camaraderie with your fellow sufferers. Mats Hummels always complained, but he ran too. Gundogan's problems extended into the first half of the season. He was introverted and immature, he says, spending a little too much time with family and friends, playing with the handbrake on, worried about making mistakes. Klopp saw that, he says, and he scared me a bit too, to be honest. I sometimes didn't immediately understand what it was he wanted me to do. It took time until the penny dropped for me. For the legs and for the head, Dortmund's specific way of playing was tough to adjust to, let alone the higher quality of his teammates. Gundogan. We practice a lot of gegenpressing. Klopp said the first 1-2 seconds after losing the ball were decisive. We shouldn't be upset about losing the ball, but actually be happy about being able to win it back. The idea was to attack the ball straight away, to surprise the opponent. They felt secure, they weren't ready for that. The new arrivals' strife in the first half of the season coincided with Dortmund's failure to make their mark on the Champions League. History repeated itself on the international stage. Having got knocked out in the Europa League group stage in the previous year when Paris Saint-Germain, Sevilla and Karpaty Lviv had proved too strong and Dortmund too gung-ho, Klopp's men finished last in a group with Arsenal, Marseille and Olympiakos. We lacked experience, says Watzke. Neither the team nor the coach had been in the Champions League before. We turned up in Athens, Marseille and London and played the way we played in the Bundesliga, but the level is beyond compare. In the Champions League, every little mistake gets punished. We pressed really high up the pitch. That didn't work. Every game was the same. We were the better team. We created good chances. We didn't score. We lost 2-0 or 3-0. The year after that, we changed our style of playing. We were up against Real Madrid and Manchester City in the group stage then, and we went through. It was a learning process for the team, Gundogan says. We were all quite young and naive. These European teams were a little too street smart for us. But we heeded the lessons, just as I did for my game. Introspection came by way of an involuntary spell in the stands. Klopp took me aside one day and said, "This won't be easy for you, but you won't be involved at the weekend." There was no explanation. He had never criticised me or told me, "You're playing shit" or stuff like that. But he's a clever guy. He knew he had his reasons for not including me in the squad. It was like a riddle that I had to solve. What was I supposed to do? What am I going to do here? I had 1,000 questions in my head, but after a while I cracked it. I deciphered the code. Gundogan came on 9 minutes into the game against Hanover in February 2012 after Sven Bender had picked up one of his many injuries. He was a revelation. It kind of clicked. The shackles were off. I became part of the first team and everything kind of just happened. It all flowed naturally. My football, the relationship with my teammates, and with Jürgen. One awkward incident in training sealed their bond. Gundogan had been due to play in the first team against the reserves in the important Wednesday session, when the weekend's match was simulated. Getting up in the morning, he felt a tightness in his hamstring. Players with injury concerns were supposed to come in 90 minutes to 2 hours early to get assessed by the physio and enable the coaching staff to find a replacement from the amateur team or under-19s if need be. Gundogan thought he could train but decided to seek out the physio 30 minutes before the session started. He looked at it and said, "I have to tell the coach. There's a danger you might get injured." I said, "Okay, but please tell him that I can play." A few minutes later, the door opened and Jürgen walks in. This giant of a man, looking at me angry. "What the hell are you playing at?" he shouted. "It's okay, coach, I can play, I just wanted to make sure." He reminded me about coming in an hour and a half early. He was quite upset with me. "Do whatever you want," he said, and left. I thought, shit, what do I do now? Gundogan was the first man out on the pitch. Klopp called him over. He walks a few steps with me, away from the boys, and goes, "My friend, you can understand me, right?" "Yes, I do, I just wanted to..." "No, you don't understand. The next time you have any problems, even if it's just a little twinge, or your bum is itchy, or whatever, you call the doctor or the physio. You can even call me first thing in the morning and break my balls. Just tell us, okay, coach? You'll join in the warm-up, but then you go off before the game starts. But I want to train. Be quiet. You'll go off." Then he laughed and hugged me. I asked once more if I shouldn't stay for training, but he sent me back in after another hug. He became more than a coach for me after that. We had a special connection, and a very successful one. Dortmund's European woes had no negative impact on their form in the league. On the contrary, from October 2011 onwards, they went on a domestic rampage of 28 games without defeat. Once more, a win over Bayern, Dortmund's fourth successive defeat of the Bavarians, decided the title race. The home side's perfect midfield positioning created a kill zone near the halfway line where most Bayern attacking moves went to die in the first half. Bayern did a little better after the break as the black and yellows tired, but Arjen Robben missed a penalty and Lewandowski's goal secured all 3 points in the heaving Signal Iduna Park. Dortmund moved 6 points clear at the top with 4 games to go. "We can hardly play any better," Klopp exclaimed. The 44-year-old was reluctant to acknowledge the true importance of the win as far as the title race was concerned. "A lot can happen before the end of the season," he cautioned, "but we'll have 3 days to celebrate and enjoy tonight's extraordinary event." A few players took that declaration perhaps too seriously. Gundogan. That Wednesday after the Bayern game, 5 of us went out partying. We didn't drink but stayed in a club until 2 or 3. The problem was they had a game against Schalke on Saturday, the derby. Schalke went 1-0 up, but Dortmund won 2-1. The players went partying again. The next morning, Klopp addressed the team at the training ground. "Somebody told me a few of you went out during the week. I don't know who, and I don't want to know. But I can tell you, these players should be happy we won yesterday. Otherwise, we would have seen the biggest punishment in the history of club football." The players looked at each other and thought, "Fuck, thank God we turned that game around." We went out quite often as a team then, 8 or 10 people at a time. There were a lot of singles in the squad. Sometimes you could see the after effects in training on Sunday morning, but I don't think we ever overdid it. It made us more of a unit, I believe. Klopp's ambition to win every game did not diminish after Dortmund were confirmed as champions again. His team duly went on to set a new points record for the Bundesliga, 81. "Generally speaking, all our games that year were amazing," Gundogan smiles. "We dominated the opposition, Klopp style. They didn't know what hit them. We basically mugged them. They couldn't deal with it. That gave us an extra good feeling. We didn't steal the points. We knew they have no chance against us. One game against Köln, we were 1-0 down at half-time. No one knew why. We won 6-1. We were so good that it didn't matter if the opposition took the lead. In those years, we played a new kind of football in Germany, Kiel adds. We simply swamped or overwhelmed other teams. They were completely helpless. Borussia's appetite was not yet satisfied. 4 weeks after winning the league, they had the chance to achieve the club's first ever double. Jupp Heynckes's Bayern stood in their way in the final in Berlin. It would, as Watzke puts it, turn into a game of fundamental importance for both clubs. Throughout his first successful cup run as coach, Klopp had shown the team edited highlights from previous wins, underlaid with dramatic music. The night before the final, a motivational video comprising historic achievements such as the moon landing, Boris Becker's win at Wimbledon in 1985, and Muhammad Ali's rumble in the jungle ramped up the emotional temperature. "We told the boys, our own film is not over yet," Klopp said in an interview with Redaktions Network Deutschland. "You have to wait for the right moment with these things. Then they're great." 23 years had passed since Dortmund's last win in the cup. Less than 3 minutes into the match, Dortmund were 1-0 up through Shinji Kagawa. Robin and Hummels both converted penalties, then Lewandowski scored BVB's third on the stroke of half-time. The 3-1 lead enabled the black and yellows to play on the counter-attack after the break, setting up traps that the Bavarians stumbled into like a pack of doddering bears. Dortmund played more defensively, more sneakily, more calculatedly, Süddeutsche Zeitung wrote, full of admiration. They aren't just German champions, but also cup winners in the forcing of opposition errors. The mighty Bayern were dismantled, humiliated, as Klopp's men romped to victory in the Olympic Stadium. Lewandowski ended up with a hat-trick in the 5-2 win. This was not coincidence. Bayern CEO Karl-Heinz Rummenigge conceded in front of sponsors and VIP guests at the midnight banquet. This was an embarrassment. Every goal was like a slap in the face for us. On the pitch, Watzke and Zorc had quietly shed tears of joy on the most extraordinary moment in Borussia's history, as Klopp acknowledged. "He had danced in the dressing room with a beer in his hand like one of us," Gundogan smiles. The coach told reporters that Norbert Dickel, goalscorer in the 1989 final, had given him his right shoe as a good luck token the night before. It had been in his basement for more than 20 years and smelt a bit, he laughed. But supernatural powers or good luck didn't come into it, neutral experts noted. Dortmund beating Bayern for the fifth time running was a feat both unparalleled and well-deserved. Their superior system, application, and transfer policy had negated the giant's array of star individualists with huge financial advantage. "It's a power shift," De Velt attested. Dortmund have replaced Bayern at the top of the German football food chain. "The system that Jürgen, Schalke, and Pete played dominated German football for 2 years," says Dickel. "Nobody had the faintest idea how to deal with our aggressive pressing and our doubling up or tripling up on players. Even Bayern didn't know what was going on. It was a wonderful time, more spectacular than the wins in the mid-90s. We were carried along on this wave. We went into every game knowing we would destroy the other team. We were drunk on euphoria. We had all gone BVB crazy. It was a trip." That night in Berlin, Klopp was Mr. Big, a shell suit pusher delivering a legal high of almost unbearable potency to millions of Borussia loyalists. The name of his drug was love. "I relish the total intensification when bangs go off everywhere," he told Die Zeit a few months later. That phrase of all or nothing, when it feels as if people don't dare to breathe. Martin Kvast had watched the cup final in an old Jürgen Köhler shirt in the stadium. Afterwards, he saw Klopp and his team singing songs in the little tent that broadcasters ZDF had put up behind the marathon gate. At the end of the live programme, as Klopp was carrying the Golden Cup and Silver Championship trophy, affectionately known as the Salad Bowl, Kvast shouted "Gude," the traditional Mainz greeting, at his friends and told him that his shoelaces had come untied. He was laughing his head off. Then he gives me the bowl and the cup and goes, "Hold this for a second," and then he ties his laces. A quick high five, and then he says, "It's a shame, but I have to go," picking up the cup and the bowl again. Cool, isn't it? It could have been a bottle of wine and a ring of sausages. He didn't think about it for one moment. Cup, championship, trophy. So what? That's him. What normal person would do such a thing? Alex Ferguson was another observer who had enjoyed the show in Berlin. The Manchester United coach had travelled to Germany to cast an eye over Kagawa and Lewandowski. He sat four places to the left of me, Vatska says. I told him he could have one, Kagawa, but not the other. He looked at me a little dumbfounded. The Japanese midfielder would leave for the Premier League at the end of the season. Barrios, now surplus to requirements, was sold to Guangzhou Evergrande. All the other regulars stayed, plenty of attractive bids notwithstanding. Vatska was under no illusions about the size of the challenge that awaited him and Zorc, however. The Bavarian Empire was poised to strike back. We were intoxicated. It was an epochal evening for us, but also the high point. The best day in the job for me. I felt it. I remember lying awake in bed at 4 a.m, staring at the Brandenburg Gate. You just knew it would get difficult from now on, that there would be a reaction, that Bayern would be out for revenge and start targeting our players. They had played 40 finals before, I think, but never conceded 5 goals. They felt humiliated. That moment, they radically changed policy. They went all in, investing money like never before in the squad, and it paid off for them. Dortmund's trick of being much bigger than the sum of their parts, a feat of football alchemy conjured up by the grand wizard Klopp, had, to some extent at least, relied on the biggest team failing to make the most of their potential. Bayern broke their own transfer record to buy holding midfielder Javi Martinez from Athletic Bilbao, 40 million euros, as well as Mario Mandzukic, 11 million euros, VfL Wolfsburg, winger Jerdan Shaqiri, 11.8 million euros from FC Basel, and defender Dante, 4.7 million euros, Borussia Mönchengladbach. The increase in individual quality, especially at the back, had a very welcome tactical knock-on effect. Bayern's former sporting director, Matthias Sammer, explains. More stability in defence made it possible for midfield and attack to press higher. Bayern's game became more flexible, more dynamic. Klopp wasn't the only one who found the Bavarian new direction eerily familiar. They've done to us what the Chinese do in industry, he complained. They see what others are doing, copy it, and then go down the same route with more money than other players. Bayern, having taken on elements of Dortmund's game and become more like Dortmund than Dortmund themselves, Ralf Rangnick observed. Imitation might be the sincerest form of flattery, but that was scant consolation to Klopp, whose careful 4-year building work was put in the shade by a shiny, super-expensive skyscraper next door, partially using his own blueprint. Bayern's novel sense of humility without the ball, their much improved intensity and tactical awakening, made for a devastating combination. Henkes's men won the Bundesliga with a new points record, 91, notching up 10 more than Dortmund in the previous season, before adding the DFB Pokal to their trophy cabinet. After 2 seasons of dragging Bayern down to our level, Klopp, Borussia's excellence had inadvertently raised the Reds' game. The effect on the rest of the league was similar. Taking inspiration from the double winners, more and more teams started to include pressing and gegenpressing in their tactical repertoire, fighting fire with fire. Suddenly, everybody did it. That's when we realised how brutally difficult it is to play against a team like that, Subotic says. Opponents also adopted a second countermeasure. Since Dortmund's game was built on rapid moments of transition after winning the ball, teams happily ceded both the ball and space, forcing BVB to play a slower possession game. Klopp's racing car of a side now frequently got stuck in traffic. Our way of playing had encouraged all smaller teams, says Gundogan. They thought, we can beat teams who are actually better than us by adopting these tactics and getting it right. Dortmund picked up 15 points fewer than in the previous season, but second place was not seen as failure. They needed to grow as a club. Champions League qualification was more important than defending their trophies. The slight domestic setback was more than compensated by a thrilling international adventure. Klopp's men, dubbed the hottest team in Europe by 442 magazine, outsmarted a number of sides ill-prepared for the ferocity of their finely honed drive-by shooting approach. An early indication of Borussia's greater maturity in matches against the continent's elite came in the second game of the group stage away to Manchester City. The visitors, spurred on by their fanatical travelling support, played the world's most expensively assembled team off the pitch at the Etihad. They were in charge for most of the game, flowing forward in yellow and black waves like New York taxicabs rushing to collect wealthy fares on Wall Street, gushed the Daily Telegraph. Dortmund took the lead through Marco Reus and had enough chances to score 3 more. A last-minute penalty, converted by Man City substitute striker Mario Balotelli, made a mockery of their dominance. They were a different class tonight, starting with their fans, City keeper Joe Hart admitted. But the manner of the 1-1 draw left Klopp satisfied, verging on proud. The BVB coach was more unnerved by the questions about the penalty decisions than the two dropped points. Such